Our next speaker is Professor John Buchanan, who's the Director of Workplace Research Centre at the University of Sydney. And John's going to speak to us on understanding the workforce participation. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I had been told I had a 40-minute slot, and it shrunk to about 15 now. So what I might do is limit my presentation to, say, 20 minutes and leave 5 minutes for questions. Is that all right? And that'll leave the people coming after with 25 minutes. Is that okay? Yeah? Okay. So just as a bit of background, I'd like to thank the organisers of this conference for inviting me here today. Narrabri is a fairly unique place in my experience. Our centre is made up of 25 staff, and we study the changing nature of work all around the country. One of our major findings for the last out of the last 15 years of research is that there needs to be a closer integration of the development of the workforce with local economies. And there are very few places around the country where this is happening, and there is an interest in the Narrabri area, particularly within its Chamber of Commerce and its local government, to do something about it. So it was a privilege to be invited to the deliberations here today, and it's good to see the CRC getting behind it. In giving you insights to our latest research, I'd like to acknowledge that the work I'll be drawing on was primarily done by Justine Everson and Michelle Jakubauskas at our centre, and the work was sponsored by the Victorian Government. I hope there's no one from the Victorian Government here, but I have to say they're very good at commissioning research but not very good at taking it up. And it's good to see that there are other people interested in our findings, and you'll see that I've got some ideas in here that I think are very relevant to a group such as this, particularly on how you take these ideas forward. So, do I just push that one? Good. Okay. Just quickly by way of introduction, I want to give you the take-home message from the research, outline our methods, point you to the summary of the findings, and in this, let me try that. There we go. I'll just do it like that. Summarise our findings, particularly about the importance of different labour pools. Note that there are unsustainable flows of types of labour, and argue that there's a key role for intermediaries. And in thinking about moving forward, outline three models for workforce development. So what's the take-home message? I don't need to tell people here that rural Australia is suffering from absolutely terrible constraints. I'm not talking the sector down. I agree with the previous speaker there, but I do think we need to be realistic. There are huge pressures on the rural sector and regional areas that need to be grasped. We need to recognise that the Australian rural regions, and particularly the primary industry sector, has been incredibly dynamic. In fact, it's one of the world's most efficient agricultural sectors, and this is not appreciated by the population at large. And we want to argue that the source of dynamism on the production side needs to be taken into the workforce side. And like the first speaker, I want to argue that you can't solve these issues at the level of simply primary industries or agriculture or mining. You've got to do it on a total locality basis. So what were our questions for the research? We had three. What shapes workforce development in primary industries? And I will be focusing on primary industries, but it has broader relevance to rural and regional Australia. How viable are these models for the future? And what can be done to support sustainable workforce development? I don't normally bore people with our research methods, but I do really want to emphasise that this was based on studies in Victoria, and the thing Justine and Michelle did is that they went to a lot of trouble to get to farm workers, not just farmers. Now, I know farmers often feel they don't have a voice, but if farmers feel disenfranchised, you should talk to farm workers. And if they're interested in workforce development, it's good to get a perspective from what farm workers themselves think. So, what did we find? This is a large part of the report, and I've crunched it down to one slide, but basically we argue in making sense of the workforce development challenges in the rural sector, you've really got to break the workforce down into two basic categories, those who have ongoing jobs and those who have seasonal work. Amongst those doing ongoing jobs, there are farm operators and general farm workers. And amongst the farm operators, there are classical farmers and then farm managers. And you'll see within the farm manager category, we've drawn out professional general farmers from the field farmers and agricultural graduate farmers. So what you can see is we've descended into quite some detail what are the different tributaries to the different occupations within that basic farm operator category, and there are different forces at work, with the key one being that the classic owner-occupier farmer is no longer the centrepiece. If you like, it's a decaying core of a dynamic sector. And now we've got people who used to be very good at production, that's no longer good enough. They have to be extremely good business people as well, and this is why we're seeing the rise of professional managers and agricultural graduate farmers. When we get to general farm workers, they're an endangered species. And we spent a lot of time getting information on this group. Everyone wants a good general farm hand or a good general farm worker, but history is not on their side. As the previous speaker noted, you know, up until the 1930s, around one Australian worker in three or four was actually on the land. That's now down to less than 5%. Technology is stripping out that labour. As cost pressures bite, farmers themselves are putting in more time, and that reduces the demand for general hands. And so we've got to really think, if we want good general farm workers, you've got to think about what kind of future we're creating, because at the moment we're on an atrophy model where we're actually running down that occupation. Amongst seasonal workers, there's also been a big change. If we think back to the 1920s and the 1930s, there was a harvest trail. You know, poems written about this stuff, songs are rung about it. Well, it's basically fragmenting. And instead of a coherent harvest trail, there are still some professional pickers and pruners, but they, once again, are a dying breed. And instead, we're getting transient, what we call transient independence. These are grey nomads and backpackers. But there's increasing reliance on migrant labour, some of whom are getting paid as low as, with the lowest rate we found was $11.50 for 12 hours work. There's also significant reliance, and some farmers systematically build up production systems around this. And then when you get to machine contractors in Broadacre, there are farmers who do this work as part-time machine contractors, but there are also harvest trail contractors. Both these clusters, or these groups of machine contractors in Broadacre farming, have very little time to train new people to come up behind them. They are so busy either sourcing work or doing the work that they don't have time to take out to train new people to come up behind them. Now, I've bolted through a lot of stuff there. If you want to read this stuff, it's all in our report. But this basically points to our key findings. If I can just get to the next slide. Is that right? Yeah, once that would be good. So what are the kind of underlying dynamics behind these workforce issues? It's kind of like when in Rome, but an expression we use in understanding workforce development comes from Dick Dusseldorp, who was a very famous contractor who built up a Lend-Lease corporation. And he said employers who do not invest in the development of their workforce are like farmers who eat their seeds. You can do that for a season, but then you lose the capacity to move into the future and grow in the future. And that's very much what's happening with the primary industry's workforce now. There's a stock of skills which have come from previous generations which are being slowly burned up. And you see that in the average age of a farmer, and you're seeing it in the growing reliance on the grey nomads and the backpackers. Traditional pools of skilled labour are drying up as the traditional family farm shrinks in significance, and you get the rise in corporate farming and larger dynamic family farms. The source of skilled agricultural labour disappears, and amongst successful farms, many children no longer aspire to agricultural work but head into professional occupations because they're coming from an environment which is more business oriented than agriculturally oriented. Low employment standards are getting lower. And in a sense, farmers have terrible problems here. They've had terrible weather conditions. They've had cost pressures imposed on them by ultimate purchases of their goods and major international competition. But unless something's done about employment standards, the signals that comes out of this sector are not attractive to many workers. Finally, just to get down to the bottom, these problems are being solved by, in the short term, relying on contractors and labour hire, but that's very much a last gasp. That's turning to organisational forms that simply redeploy the labour you've got. Contractors and labour hire are mainly interested in deploying labour, not developing it, and they're not actually contributing to moving forward. They're helping solve an immediate situation. And all this is happening in a context where the knowledge expected of people on the land is rising because of the complexity of production processes. Oops. But then the third thing we found in our project, which was incidental but quite important, is that the way forward in this situation is not to simply, you know, hope that things will get better, that the weather will turn right or something. We've actually got to think of new ways of spreading risks. And when you employ some or choose to invest in them, there is a risk there. Because when you employ someone, you're not sure how good they'll be as a performer. When you invest in them in a training sense, you're not sure whether they'll hang around. And the only way to manage these risks is to share them amongst a larger group of workers and a larger group of employers. And the agricultural sector and primary industries has been especially good at sharing risks in research and development. You have levies on milk for building up your research capacity. You have extension services which are partially funded by farmers themselves. These are great traditions for sharing the costs of developing something that's a benefit to all. And we think that this idea of intermediaries as a critical public good needs to be taken from production techniques and taken into the use of primary industry labour. Oops. So, what do we recommend? I'm short of time, so I'll be extremely blunt. We do lots of this research for lots of different people. I've worked with Ruth Nettle, who you'll be hearing from later. And the problem now is not fundamentally a research problem, the problem is a leadership problem. Unless there are critical masses of employers at local level who are prepared to take responsibility, nothing much can be done. And as you'll see in the recommendations we'll be putting forward, we think it's a time for hard decisions to be made in how we actually build up new networks of regional development, and we think significant support should be given to those regions where farmers and local employers say we will take collective responsibility to try and do something about this, and regions where farmers don't do that should not get the support. There needs to be hard decisions made so that where people are doing something sensible, they get the support instead of money being thinly spread across everyone. Can we also say there's a need to have more dynamism and creativity amongst those networks of employers? When we're looking at the dairy industry, about 6 or 7 years ago, I put a research offline for 3 days. She identified over 60 different sources of funding for workforce development in rural and regional Australia. Now, that was one of my professional researchers spending 3 days. Most people don't have that luxury. There's something fundamentally dysfunctional in the way in which we organise funding, and we need to build up the expertise in the first instance to bring all those pools together to get something sensible up, but in the longer term we need different funding models. Sorry. You're taking it. Okay. So what are the recommendations for moving forward? So the preconditions for a sustainable initiative is this. There's got to be labour demand, and this is where I agree with the last speaker. In some areas, there just isn't going to be the demand to hold people in a region, and hard decisions are going to have to be made that the labour is going to have to be redeployed from those areas. There needs to be clear examples where people are prepared to share the risks in moving forward, and this is usually helped by regional cohesion. There need to be clear champions who are prepared to take the initiative forward, who are supported by experts and good intermediaries. That is a pretty high hurdle to cross. But for the sake of discussion here today, I'm saying I think we've got to raise the bar so that we can make sure that the money we spend actually makes a difference. Because we've seen that we've funded a whole lot of disparate initiatives, and still we hear this headlong and ongoing argument that nothing seems to be working. Well, what we're saying, think differently. Let's actually have some pretty tight preconditions and put the money where it's likely to make a difference. Next overhead, please. So, what are our suggestions here? Well, there need to be existing initiatives around seasonal labour, and here there was one that's been floated in this district that I think is worthy of close attention, and that's coordinating the calendar between employers in the mining industry and the primary industry so that you can move your labour around and coordinate the demand for labour instead of having the demand for labour jamming at certain times. An example of this is provided by the Fire and Ice Initiative, which the Queensland Government supported, and that links tourist operators on the snowfields with tourist operators in Queensland, where the demand for tourist labour varies by season, and they actually, if you like, have like a harvest trail, but instead of a harvest trail around primary goods, they've got, if you like, a harvest trail around harvesting tourists. and they actually have this idea of getting a more coherent flow of labour and delivering that. On the experimental side, I think there's a need to be a bit more adventurous. Australia has been extremely dynamic in keeping its apprenticeship system alive. For those of you who may not know, apprenticeship systems are extremely rare around the world. Australia has one of the few fully functioning apprenticeship systems going. One of the reasons it has that is it has a very dynamic infrastructure, and a key part of that is the group training model. And under the group training model, the risks of hiring an apprentice are shared amongst a group of employers, and the problems that don't adhere simply on the one employer. I think this is something we've got to look at, the role of larger family farms taking a responsibility for being a flywheel for workforce development, but not doing it on their own. They need the support of something like a group training company, and they need to be networked with other farmers in the district. So if demand drops away in their area, they can share that labour around with us and reduce the burden. Next slide, please. Oop, is that it? Okay. So just to sum up, this is research. I've truncated and boiled it to try and give us a bit of time for questioning. We've been looking at the workforce development, and I think with business development, for about 10 to 15 years now. We are now strongly of the view that the critical issue is leadership. We can, as researchers, provide information, we can provide you with insights, we can provide you with models of what works and what doesn't. But unless there's a critical mass, especially of employers and local governments, nothing will happen. And it's for this reason that we propose that we change funding models, that we actually go through that checklist I outlined earlier, and it's only those regions which conform to that checklist that will get a significant amount of funding and make a difference. And in that way, you'll get a competition going amongst regions, but a healthy-based competition where people are looking at how they can get together and solve problems as opposed to everyone scrapping over a declining pie. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We do have time for some questions we need to make use of John while we've got him here. So have we got some mics? And do we have some questions?
Thanks, John. You're talking about these new models of research at Chasm and Epsilon. Where is the source of this new leadership going to come from? Does it come from the formation of this new funding model? Is that going to emerge from that? Or is it something that regions just have to get on and start meeting and sort of
I think the first speaker used the argument that government should be facilitating and not trying to do all this. I am strongly supportive of that. But I think we've also got to recognise that employers can't do this on their own. There's what's known in economics as the common property problem, that why it's not in the interest of any one employer to solve a problem that many of them have. So no one employer will step up to the plate to solve the business development problem. They might do it for their farm, and they might bid their wage up to get quality labour out to their farm, but that actually doesn't solve the problem at large. So from my experience, the people who impress me most are what I call the practical intellectuals amongst the employer community. These are extremely good people, they're often civic-minded, but they get very little public support. And what we need to do is get structures of government support which identify these people and support them in a very tangible sense. And that's not saying supporting them by getting them to become chair of the local workforce development task force. That's not good enough. I think anyone in this room knows, anyone who's any good is already flat out, right? And these practical intellectual leading farmers are already stretched to the board. So we've got to think creatively about how we have backfilling arrangements. We've got to have things like extension services for quality farm labour so that good farmer can be released, say, for a year or two to build up a workforce development network, but he or she can know that there's a good farm manager in behind them keeping the farm ticking over because they don't want to risk their own business for the sake of the locality. So we've got to think quite systematically about what it takes to liberate the good leadership that's there, and public policy has been very bad at that. I think public policy, particularly in the vocational education training area, has said if there's a representative from an employer body sitting on the panel, that's employer leadership. From my experience, the connection between what those official bodies are saying and what employers on the ground think and do is very different. And I think what we've got to do is try and get to the farmers and the employers on the ground, but in a very tangible way. So what I'm proposing is quite ambitious. I mean, there isn't a stock standard solution I'm willing to add here. I'm not saying privatise this or have a government program there. I'm saying we've actually got to build up new structures of support. But can I say, if there's one area that can do it, it's going to be rural Australia. Because rural Australia has been incredibly dynamic. I mean, you go back to the 19th century, you know, Australia led the pack in agricultural productivity. Now, it still leads the pack in agricultural productivity. That's no mistake, because we have very dynamic arrangements for sharing and pooling risks around research and development. I'm saying, well, let's not stop there. Let's take that into the labour market. Let's not just stop at how we produce things. Let's look at how we look after ourselves and our workforce. And it's easy to say, but it's hard to do. But I think you do have traditions to draw back on to make that happen.
At the back here.
There's one over.
Just following on from that, can I ask you to raise the question, if you're proposing that leading farmers go and take leadership roles, who pays the farm manager back?
Sure.
Is there money involved?
Absolutely.
Because people are so busy trying to make ends meet.
Yep.
And as you say, a lot of the leadership people are already in cities, committee or involved. How do we encourage people to take on even more than what they're on their plate if they're going to be
I think this should all be fully funded. This is why I say this is quite ambitious and quite radical. I mean, I'm not expecting that farmer to then be a volunteer in leading the workforce development panel or the workforce task force. That would be a paid position, and it should be handsomely paid. You know, I'd be thinking $100,000, $200,000. This is a hard job. Right, you need someone with diagnostic skills, you need someone with networking skills, you need someone with diplomatic and political skills. These are rare people. You have to pay them properly. And so that's a job. And they shouldn't have to give up their life. I mean, it's a quite different sort of funding model I've got in mind. But I would say the crisis is so deep when it comes to workforce that if Australia wants to keep half its export capacity up, it's going to have to think pretty radically about how it shores up the capability moving that into the future. But there are models for this, for backfilling people, and it happens in some corporations. So it's not totally unprecedented, but it's not done as a public good. You know, companies do it within companies they give people sabbaticals or whatever. I'm saying as a society, we've got to give some of our farm leaders sabbaticals with support to actually help renew their sector. So, I'm talking about serious funding here, but I'm saying you don't pour more money into agriculture. You look at, Australia's traineeship numbers went from 150,000 to 400,000 in 5 years. Right, that's huge. Think of Canberra. Canberra was basically turned into one big traineeship camp. You know, that's the scale of the intervention in the labour market. Employer training expenditure was stagnant. Now, there's a lot of money going into traineeships. Employers aren't putting more money into training them. It's a wage subsidy. And, there's lots of work on this. The quality of traineeships is a very variable quality. Some of them are really good, but there are some very marginal ones, which are basically employers getting cheap money. And I'm saying, let's change the funding model. Where employers do it well, they should get a lot of money. And if they're just simply putting their hand up saying, I want a subsidy, cut that out. So I think the money's there. It's just got to be redeployed.
I just call to mind that local government in this area coordinated a push by the whole of regional government of Australia about 10 years ago, suddenly worried for what became the rest of the country program. It was originally a 4-year program. As it came to an end, local government pulled together so powerfully that every city-based member of Canberra became aware that bush would burn if the current program was to continue, and it continues to this day. Current program was continuing. Influence in Canada, the sort of national program process we're looking at, get up, be heard. But the other point about local government is that they don't know who goes and puts the constitutional recognition. I'm very sympathetic to that. And I do think that when local government puts up the right people and performs strongly, it can be heard in Africa and presumably in Forest Street, that's all. I'd just be interested in your views on whether we could do more than that area and whether in fact constitutional recognition of local government might help.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I'm down here today, because the local government supporting this initiative and the local Chamber of Commerce. I mean, to me, there's a lot of dynamism at that level. But once again, can I say it is of very variable quality? Once again, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, but, you know, some local governments are dominated by real estate agents. And I think we've got to be, if we want to raise the status of local government, which I'm very keen to, I think we've got to find means of, first of all, making involvement in it worthwhile. So I think they've got to be paid properly. And I think that we've got to have funding arrangements which are biased towards supporting dynamic local governments. Ones that make a difference, ones that, you know, if you say they've taken the initiative for roads recovery, presumably that was a lot of hard work and a lot of it done on top of everything else. I'm saying that's got a limited life, that model. You know, there will be a few champions who'll do it for a while, but then, you know, they'll have to go back to their families or they've just got to go back to run their businesses. I'm saying we've got to get beyond the kind of episodic vision of innovation and actually make it more systematic, and that goes to underlying salary structures, but also funding models which reward good performance and just don't simply equalise funding on the basis that you've got a population, therefore you're entitled to money. I mean, can I say, what I'm saying is quite provocative. You know, I'm from the left, I support egalitarianism, but I do think if we're keen to break out of the current stalemate we're in, we've really got to fund some things that make a difference. And I'm proposing more discrimination in how you would back to local governments. I think that's got to be critical.
John, with the survey, you mentioned the level of action going into the farm workers,
yes, yes,
which is very hard to get to.
Yes, absolutely.
Did you want to make a comment about how if farmers are now looking at a sort of business approach, they look at the labour as an input cost, yep, or a development cost in their, yep, business, and how the farm workers are perceiving their position within that business?
Look, I really want to give full credit to Justine and Michelle. They went crazy trying to find farm workers. It's extremely expensive to locate them and get them to turn up and be interviewed. I mean, it sounds simple. You bump into them in the street, but to actually get them in a research project is extremely hard. It was the hardest part of this exercise. And I have to say, they reported profound variability amongst the farming community. We got great stories of farmers who paid well over the award. If there was a good harvest, they shared that quite generously with the workforce, went out of their way to encourage people to spend time with their family after they'd had, say, a six-week burst. But then we found another dairy farmhand who'd worked for 6 weeks straight and had one day off with no recognition. And, you know, they're the extremes. And I'd have to say there are more down the bottom than there are at the top. And this, In a sense, it's not a personal failing. You know, these aren't evil farmers down the bottom. They're scrounging for an existence themselves. This is why I'm saying you've got to look at means where farmers can communicate more with each other and share the risks and the burdens more fairly. But from where the farm workforce sits, we found no farm worker who was encouraging their children to even become farmers. None were saying become a farm worker, none. You know, that feeder group is just telling their children, get out of here as fast as you can. And they're saying, look at the farmer, would you actually want to turn out like that when you get burdened with the debt? So this is where, you know, you've got to look at the signals you're sending. Can I say the Australian farm industry is not unique there? Only 4% of Japanese car workers want their children to enter that industry too. So, you know, don't beat yourselves up too much. But there is an issue, right? There is an issue, and it doesn't have to be like that. I mean, I think, as I said, the industry has shown over literally centuries that it's dynamic and innovative, but it's got to break out of the way in which it thinks of labour and uses labour. It's got to think in the way it thinks about how it shares costs and risk around production. It's got to think about how it does that around work as well. Okay.
Please join me in thanking John again.